Welcome back to Computer Science E1. Welcome back to Computer Science E259, XML with J2EE. My name is David Malin. This is Lecture 2, XML 1.1 and SACS 2.0.2. Recall that last time we began our discussion, among other things, with a look at bingo destinations, a look at the course, but we did bite off a bit of actual material last week, looking at J2EE quite briefly, certainly. We'll more on that as the semester progresses, but then a little bit about the syntax or fundamentals of XML. Just to get the blood flowing this evening, XML in a sentence. What is it?
Extensible markup language.
Okay, extensible markup language. So we're already one up on bingo destinations.
It describes the data.
So it's a language for describing data. Sure.
Easy to transport the data in between the platform because it is a platform independent.
Okay, platform independent, easy to transfer. Excellent. Of the 10 design principles that the W3C set out to achieve with the design of XML, what one or two come to mind?
Human readable,
which, as I've already said in lecture one, is not a feature to be underestimated in terms of its utility. I'm sorry? It can be validated and can conform to what's called the DTD, or XML schema, and we'll get to that in just a couple of lectures' time.
It's not terse,
is a nice way of putting it, and we'll actually put that into perspective in just a moment. In fact, what I thought might be an interesting way to motivate not so much this lecture in and of itself, but really where we're going in the course is more of a real-world, a development-oriented example. What I've been working on over the past couple of weeks for research, if you'll recall from last week, is software related to the detection of worms. Long story short, my research focuses on the use of peer-to-peer cooperation to detect what would otherwise be deemed as too many correlations in the behavior of hosts participating on a network. So in short, these Windows machines are designed to be running software that on a local machine essentially monitors all of their internal behaviors, focusing in particular on their system calls. What the software is then designed to do is on some schedule, every 10 seconds, 15 seconds, 30 seconds, it's designed to essentially upload the recent behavior that a particular machine has evinced to some central server. Meanwhile, many other clients are doing the same, and the role of this central server is to analyze all of those traces of system calls and look in a central repository if there are unusual correlations or patterns emerging, which might suggest in our research that there is a fast-spreading worm behaving on each of these otherwise independent hosts. So writing the Win32 code for this is sort of an interesting challenge unto itself, hooking the kernel and so forth on Windows. Writing the server code is not really a hard thing. If you're just handed all of the data, it's not hard to write something that analyzes the arrays of data you're getting back. But it's that transport mechanism that's sort of a nuisance to implement or re-implement, because delivery of data via UDP or TCP is certainly a wheel that's already been invented. So enter into this particular project, XML RPC, which is something we'll talk about later in the semester, along with another language called SOAP, both of which are geared toward the implementation of web services, the ability to write software on machine A, but execute it from machine B, without machine B really knowing that the code is running on machine A. So consider this problem in context. What I want to do is be able to write some client-side software that happens to be written entirely in C for reasons germane to the Win32 kernel API. I, though, want to be able to marshal up all of my data, an array of counts of the number of system calls that are executed within some window of time. I want to ship those off to a server, and I want the server then to do something with that information. Moreover, I want to be able to push information back to the client so that I, as a research tool, when running this software on 20 different computers, can, with the click of a button on the server, change the parameters on all of the clients so that I can change what we dub their window size, and I can get back not windows of 30 seconds of behavior, but rather 15 seconds. So in effect, I want to be able to have a bidirectional channel here where I'd like to be able to just throw a switch on the server and the clients start behaving differently. Well, again, enter this thing known as XML RPC. In short, and as I mentioned last week, XML RPC, as its name suggests, is a means of executing remote procedure calls using XML as the transport mechanism, in effect. And a remote procedure call, just to flesh out the term, if you're unfamiliar, this kind of says it all in and of itself, but how might you elaborate? So most of you, all of you, have written LPCs before, local procedure calls, and you've probably never even called them that because it's sort of stupid to call a function a local procedure call if that's all you're familiar with. A remote procedure call, as the first term implies, is a function or a method that you might write or call on one machine, but as soon as it's invoked or executed, it's really executing somewhere else. And if you have passed in any arguments to this RPC, this function or method, well, those arguments are somehow wrapped up in some network envelope, some network packet, shipped over to that other machine, unmarshaled, as it's called, and then executed there, and then the return value comes back to you via a UDP or more likely a TCP packet. But all of that, and this is the beauty of RPC, is usually hidden from you, the programmer. You, the programmer, all you have to do is call your particular method. So how does XML, for instance, make something like this particularly easy? Well, if we take a quick look at the client-side code, which I've blown up a little bit here, and scroll down to the code in question. It's not necessary to understand this code in its entirety, certainly. The takeaway, I hope, will be the relatively few number of calls that we actually have to execute in order to achieve this task of shipping data over elsewhere without my having to write much code. What I decided to use in this C-based code, this is a sender thread, so this is the function that every n seconds actually iterates over the data structures I have on the Win32 client, wraps them up somehow, and ships them across the wire to the server. So that's what this function does. Among the things I have to declare using a C-based implementation of XML RPC are just a couple of pointers up top, an environment pointer and then some local variable pointers, essentially. I then have to make a call here, environment initialization, essentially. So a pretty straightforward requisite call. Then I make another initialization call, sort of cookie cutter code that you would copy and paste out of the README. Then if we scroll down, most of this code, messy as it is, since I whipped this up quite quickly recently, most of this code isn't even related to the XML RPC code itself. But for instance, with a call like this, in this particular library, if I want to declare a new structure, whether that's an int structure or a string or some more interesting object like a hash table, you just call something like XML RPC new. In effect, you get back an object of the type you want, but the interesting part comes down here. Essentially what I have with this call, and it's a little messy, I would concede, in C, because you're rather limited in the syntax that you can use, what this last call does is essentially build the structure, build the value that I want to ultimately ship across the wire. And in this particular case, what this rather weird syntax in C is telling me is the following. What I am about to ship across the wire, as suggested by these squiggly brackets, is a structure that has several key value pairs. The first has a key that's of type string, and its value, followed by this colon, is similarly a string. The next is similarly a string for a key, but its value is going to be an integer of some sort. String, string, and then finally, the last key is itself a string, but its value is actually in an array, indicated by the capital A there. So I've built up in my code already this array, and I've essentially mapped a pointer to that array to this variable or this placeholder A. And then what you see here, and in fact, the first string, the first key value pair that I'm sending is a string called UID, user ID for the key, and the value for testing purposes was just my own email address. And down here, U is the actual array in which I stored all of those counts. When I then ultimately call this one call, XML RPC client call underscore, I overwrote that a moment ago, asynchronous. It's a function call that returns immediately because it forks off a thread, and then all of the transport mechanisms required to send this key valued structure across the wire somewhere else is handled for me. No more code do I actually need to write. And specifically, notice that all I need to specify in this particular asynchronous call is the URL that I want to post this function call to, where I want to ship it off to, the method name that I want to be called once it arrives on that remote server, and then obviously the parameters that I've actually passed in, or rather, the parameters I want passed in, and then a pointer to the function that I would like called when the RPC gets back to me. So it's asynchronous in the sense that this function call will return immediately, but when the transport stack, the XML RPC library, receives a response from that server, it's going to automatically call this function for me. So it's an event-based trigger. Meanwhile, what's the method name? Just to put this into perspective, well, currently, the method name is just tester. But more interestingly, the URL to which I'm shipping this is just happens to be this particular IP address. This particular IP address. So in short, what ultimately happens when this code executes is that that array and all of the key value pairs I've marshaled up get shipped across the wire by some mechanism unimportant to me. On the server, upon receipt of that, that code is unmarshaled. It is passed effectively a hash table of that same structure. And as we'll see in just a second, it's Java code that happens to be running on the server. That Java code, meanwhile, looks as simple as this. And the reason I chose Java on the server end is just because I want this thing ultimately to be scalable. I'll probably wrap it in some application server or something like that, or a servlet container, and just have Apache's product deal with that issue for me. And it's just much quicker and easier to deal with Java objects, hash tables, linked lists, and so forth, because you have so much code provided to you. So all I have had to implement on the server end is the following. I've got a little main routine here that, upon initialization, just wants to know what port I want to run the server on and what window size I want to be pushing back to the client, if that client happens to ask. All of this is just uninteresting parsing of that information. But what really gets interesting is when you make these just couple of calls here. You instantiate a new web server. Well, where did that object, that class come from? That class is implemented by someone's Java-based implementation of XML RPC. So I simply import that at the top of my file. That, too, is something I downloaded from Apache. Just instantiate one of their web server objects. What do I then need to do? I just need to tell this server, when you receive a RPC call, by default, call this object. So I'm essentially saying, whenever you receive something, the default behavior should be to pass it to this object of type wormboyd, wormboyd daemon. Well, start. And it's as simple as that. So where is the matching call? Well, if we scroll down here, the method that's actually going to be called in this case is just tester. So you implement whatever method you want it to call on the client side. It's called tester. I simply make sure that it takes a parameter of type hash table, because after all, I'm shipping this thing key value pairs. The XML RPC library written in Java handles the actual wrapping, unwrapping of the data off the wire and repackaging of it in this Java-specific object in the hash table, so that when I actually receive a call to this tester method, I can simply access any of those fields that I wish. I can print out the UID. I can iterate over the array. I can print out any of the other integral or string values that arrived. And it says much code as that, and the rest of which should be, you know, familiar Java syntax, iterators, and so forth. Nothing interesting. The only magic on this server side was just instantiating some of this code, freely available, robust, scalable. Instantiate it. All the magic is taken care of for you. The end result, then, is as follows. If I simply on one line here spawn the server, which I'll arbitrarily run on my local machine for demonstration purposes on port 8081, just to show you what's happening, what I'm actually going to do is sniff our own traffic. So in this other window, I'm going to launch a TCP monitor, which is essentially like an Ethernet dump, but it's at a higher protocol layer. I'm going to say, okay, this monitor should listen on port 8080, because that's the server port that I specified in the client, but I want to forward all the traffic that comes in on port 8080 to port 8081, because after all, that's where the server is now running. So this too, just for demonstration purposes, we are imposing a man in the middle so that we can see what is going across the wire. We'll come back to this code in our lecture on web services, but for now, know that what we're about to see in this window in the bottom panes is any request that comes in and the server's corresponding response. So we get to watch. XML is human readable after all, what's going across the wire. Well, the code is this little application called Wormboy, which is now running in the system tray of the computer. So it, by default, is actually going to be shipping things off because monitor system for worms is checked, which just means on some schedule it's going to be shipping things across the wire to where is the server? Well, it's on localhost on port 8080. So let's see what happens. About 10 seconds have elapsed, and already I've hard-coded the window size to be 10 seconds originally, but now it's been changed to 30 because that's what I changed it to on the command line. So let's pull up our little sniffer here. So what has now appeared in this window, and I'm going to stop it because every 30 seconds we're going to get a new screenful, is a sample request from the client and the sample response. Well, sort of tough to see for the moment, but let's scroll down. First of all, notice the top of this, if you've seen such things before. What is, in fact, the transport protocol that XML RPC is using in this implementation? HTTP, right? I happen to be using port 8080. You could just as easily run it on port 80 itself or any other port for that matter. You can even run these kinds of RPCs over SMTP or any protocol, really, that allows you to send plain text like this. But the juicy stuff is down here. Let me choose a slightly different one. The juicy stuff is down here. Notice that after the HTTP header, you have a whole bunch of XML. And now we'll come back to this issue of verbosity in a moment, but what I'm going to do is just for a moment pretty print the output just so that we can get a sense of what's going on here. Loading a program we'll also use in a couple of weeks' time, Stylus Studio. It's a useful, and to students in the course of this term, freely available Windows product that allows you to just very easily create XML documents, XSLT documents, and other types of documents, if only because it's a nice little IDE. So I'm just going to paste in this XML because it's going to save me the time of doing all the indentation, because I can click a button and it indents everything nicely. And then notice what has happened. Is the font readable enough in back? What has happened is on the client, because I used that C-based XML RPC implementation, this XML was automatically generated when I called those build value functions and the asynchronous function call function. Notice what's in here. We have params up top followed by an individual parameter. Well, what was the first parameter as specified by that strange looking string sequence? Well, it was UID, a string, followed by another string, which happened to be my email address. And if we scroll down, we'll see the other parameters that I included. And if we scroll a bit farther down, you'll start to see a whole lot of integers, which collectively make up that array, which, to be more specific, was just an array of mapping system call unique IDs to the number of times each system call was executed during that window of time. Meanwhile, on the server end, the moment the server received that response, that method called tester that we implemented in just a few lines of code was called, performed some mathematics of some sort, and then returned some value. And what value did it return? It's a little small, I know, in this Java applet. Received. So it's very simple, but it returns a predefined tag called method response that takes some number of parameters, the only one of which has a value of quote-unquote received, exclamation point. From whence does that come? Well, notice, what was the last thing I did in this implementation? Received. But you could return anything. You could return a structure of some sort, an int of some sort, a string of some sort. And I did this without writing much code. And that, hopefully, is the takeaway. Maybe 10 lines, 6 lines of code on the C-based client, maybe same number of lines of code on the server, and what I now have is the ability to separate functionality onto multiple hosts. In particular, I have a system now where clients can communicate to a server using a protocol, if only it tends to be an open protocol that most people are not actually blocking, say, at a firewall level, which in and of itself is a useful thing. Moreover, the clients also have the ability to pull information from the server, because there was one other method that I happened to implement, quite trivially called getWS for get window size. The nice thing about that is that the clients can initiate a connection from behind their firewalls, call the server's getWS method, and all the server then can do is return WS, which was simply the integer that I happened to type at the command line argument a bit ago, 30. So, again, takeaway is not this whole discussion of worms and system calls and so forth, but just what I hope is the apparent relative ease with which you can implement such simple conceptual tasks as these, but tasks that would otherwise require learning TCP/IP socket code, both on the Java side, the C side, all of that is taken care of for you. Yeah?
I was wondering, where was the XML generated? What function generated the XML? That's what
that means. Sure, the XML that actually generated that function call.
That was generated.
Sorry.
How did you generate the XML? I didn't see the function that was.
the function that generated the XML was this one, the async call. That's it. Now, no, not at all. And again, that's the takeaway. That is a library that I discovered late one night when I wanted to implement this. I said, all right, I want to use XML RPC. Give me a C-based implementation of it. And there we go. SourceForge project. Just downloaded the object code, put it in my directory and in my library path, and done.
So the structure of the XML is, what if you wanted it to, you know, it had params and param, what if you wanted the keys to be different, the keywords to be different, or
so what do you if you want to send an arbitrary structure or you want to send different structures in the C version, and I'll concede it's a little weird in C because you're somewhat limited in your expressive syntax, the means by which you define what your structure looks like is these scanf like strings, where I'm saying, well, the structure I want to send in this program is a string value, string key integral value, and so forth. If you wanted to send something completely different, you just have to code up the structure differently in that string. And I did it iteratively. The code I skipped over is the code that actually builds up the array, because those details are sort of uninteresting or unenlightening for now, but not hard, after all. Other questions? I'm sorry? How does it handle the failovers? What you will get if there is an error is that after this call is executed, it immediately returns, after all, being the asynchronous version. If there is a failure, the most obvious one of which is going to be what, most likely? No. Right, the server's down, the network connection's not alive, you have no wireless connection on the particular client. Well, the event handler, the response handler, will still get called, which is this function, and simply in that function, which I did not point out, you can do something like this. That function is by default passed in some number of objects, one of which is an error object that you can look inside of and figure out, well, what went wrong. So quite simply, if that happens in this particular implementation, I just check, is the fault parameters fault occurred flag set? And if so, I just open an error log and say something about it. But otherwise, I let the code go about its business, because if I don't get that snapshot, the system calls frequency just then, I don't really care. I'll get the next one. So all of that is handled for you too, so long as you catch those events or check for those parameters, those flags. Yeah?
Does that include the remote side through an exception back?
Indeed. If the remote side through an exception that, for instance, was unrecoverable or was not caught, such that the server crashed, well, the C library eventually would time out on the client because the TCP socket would actually be closed by the OS or by itself. So similarly, does the C-based library then, before calling this response handler, fill in the right error flags to tell you that that was in fact the problem, an error on the server?
Well, could the remote actually send an exception string back?
Oh, absolutely. So if there is a handled exception on the server and that says poorly formatted input or, hey, you forgot the UID parameter, absolutely. The server could return any kind of object or any kind of error code. It's however you want to do it. And this was nice, because again, the purpose of this project was the research aspect of it and is the ongoing research aspect of it, and it was much easier to spend a couple of hours figuring out these libraries, playing around with them for the first time for these particular implementations, and then not having to worry about how my data is actually going to get across the wire, not having to worry about all of the various conditions that might happen occur if my test clients lose their network connection or the cable goes down or the server crashes. It's all handled for you. But there is, of course, a cost, so push back on me. Even if you were slightly impressed by the ease with which you might actually implement RPCs, there's arguably some downside here. Give me one. There's a lot of data going across the wire. Now, and granted, a lot of this is white space, but quite arguably, there is more metadata in my particular transmission than there is actual data, particularly when I'm simply transmitting integers for the most part, a couple of strings, but ultimately 32-bit integers. Much more efficient, arguably, would be for me to have implemented my own C-based code that opened a TCPI socket and just called fwrite, just called a raw write code, and then I could just write a sequence of 32-bit integers. and I could somehow embed in that stream of data the total number of them so that the server could then read that byte stream, 4 bytes at a time, unmarshal those integers using his own byte order, and then figure out exactly what those values mean. Thoughts? Reactions? That's all true. This is quite verbose. It seems to be the theme so far anyway.
So if it doesn't cost you anything, so if you have enough resources where being verbose doesn't matter to you, then it doesn't matter to you.
No.
So you just sort of make that call based on resources you have.
I think that's a perfect answer, right? It depends. It depends on what your metrics for performance are. If this is not going to be an issue, sending a bit more bits over the wire than you might otherwise with your own homegrown implementation, then fine. It's a lot quicker just to use someone else's code. It's a lot easier to be able to send, in this implementation, an arbitrary data structure that might change over time the more you modify your software. You don't have to go re-implementing or re-engineering the lower level transport protocol. Moreover, though there's a lot of metadata in here, tell me something interesting about that metadata. How else might you redress this issue? You could just suck it up and say, all right, it's a lot of data, but so be it. It was easier to code up the project this way. But you can still mitigate this concern in other ways.
Well, a lot of it's the same, so a lot of metadata is the same.
A lot of this metadata is the same, and what does that suggest? Sorry? So we could make it attributes, certainly. Then I would have to sort of find another library or tweak the library, but that might be a quicker way. Just use attributes, which we'll discuss tonight, which would just use fewer tags and fewer characters. But there's another trick, right? Even web servers and web browsers use this trick today. I mean, HTML is pretty darn verbose, and there's often way more metadata, even in HTML pages, than there is in content for some pages. Okay, so you could go back to a different format altogether, something comma separated, tab separated, whatever. But suppose that, I'm going to stick with this because the library exists, but how else might I mitigate this verbose concern? Well, what do some web servers and web browsers do these days to expedite the delivery of text-based content? They do use caching, but not so relevant for me since my data is changing. So the server is only going to see this transmission once. I'm sorry? Cookies too, but again, the data is constantly changing. And that is, after all, the point of the exercise is to get this constantly changing behavior across the wire to a server. Well, if you ever look at some MIME types, you might see mentioned in them, just compress this stuff, right? Processor speeds alone can sometimes exceed, in the aggregate, what your network bandwidth is. And so what a lot of web servers and web browsers do today, Apache's client server in particular, is if you enable the option, will compress the data that you want to send across the wire, the text-based data, the ASCII text, not the JPEGs or GIFs, which are already themselves compressed, but the uncompressed data will quickly, before it's sent across the wire, be gzipped up. The server on the other end is designed to the client rather on the other end is designed to un-gzip that, and then it shows it to the client. XML is incredibly easily compressed. Most of it, after all, is white space that you're seeing, and that's not even in the file because most of those are tab characters or the like now. But a lot of it is open bracket, close bracket, a lot of the same tag names. And so long as you use a large enough look-ahead buffer, which if you choose your compression algorithm right, you can, this can be zipped up to something quite small. And so there's another way to mitigate the concern. So we'll talk briefly later in the semester, too, about sort of the businesses that have arisen over the past couple of years, XML routers, which are these silly and simple devices that really do nothing more than implement in a piece of hardware, gzip on one end and gzip on the other end. And it's an XML router in the sense that it compresses it here, uncompresses it here. That's all it does. So this, again, just another technological approach to this. And again, as I think you pointed out perfectly, it's a trade-off. It depends on what your metrics for success or performance actually are. So with that said, let's actually delve into some of the nitty-gritty details. We will begin, after all, in this lecture with some of the basic building blocks. The first of a couple of programmatic APIs to XML, that is, mechanisms via which you can interface with it. And as the weeks proceed, we'll begin to build upon these same technologies or these foundations to more expressive, more powerful, more feature-oriented language. XSLT, for instance, and XPath being the first of those in 2 weeks' time. So let's begin, as might make the most sense, with XML itself, and flush out a few pieces of jargon just so that we have the vocabulary with which to proceed further. So here might be said to be a representative document. You should have a copy of this in tonight's lecture notes, and it's representative in the sense that I try to incorporate a little bit of all of the interesting features of XML, but all in one particular excerpt here. So let's take a look, tease this apart, but first, what is this? An excerpt from, perhaps. I'm sorry? Yeah, student information. So some kind of student database or something like that. Right? That sort of manifests in the ellipsis here just indicates that there's probably another student in this actual file. So let's tease apart some of the basic building blocks of XML because after all, as I said last week, XML, at the end of the day, open bracket, close bracket. Right? There's really not all that much more to it, but some of these details are relevant when you begin actually interfacing with it and writing code against it. So the thing up top, repeated up there in that gray box, is what's known as an XML declaration. This is something that's optional in any XML document, but if it is there, it must be the very first thing in the document. And this is one of those silly little things to bear in mind, but if you're ever getting some strange error, even with the most trivial of XML documents, if you, for better or for worse, have so much as a blank line preceding this thing, the XML parser will, by definition, choke and report an error, or it should, according to the specification. Right? The reason that it must be byte number 0 in the file is simply that if it's there, it's meant to be a way that a parser can check what the encoding type is of the file, whether it's UTF-8, UTF-16. So if it doesn't start right at the beginning, you kind of don't necessarily have the same certainty to walk away with. So what you'll see is, though we've titled this slide XML 1.1, really it's probably best even now just to output XML 1.0, for most documents, if only because the features introduced in XML 1.1 not too long ago were really not that relevant to most uses of XML. They essentially fixed some shortcomings in XML 1.0 related to control characters and what were some valid sequences of bytes that can appear in an XML file. To the typical person and application, not so much relevant. So throughout the course, what we've tended to do is keep the version number at 1.0 only so that software that might not have taken advantage of XML 1.1 or implemented the spec doesn't break. As simple as that. So what do you put in this declaration? Well, the version of XML used can be cited, and also the encoding of the document can be cited. Usually you'll see UTF-8 or some ISO variant. Usually this is not something you yourself have to think about because, again, after all, it is optional. And for most English-based text documents, just outputting plain ASCII text, which is a subset of UTF-8 anyway, is perfectly fine. But if it is there, it must be the very first item. What can also appear in an XML document is the so-called doctype elements. Neither of these, to be clear, are, the first one, though it looked like a tag or looked like an element with its open bracket question mark, it's sort of a special case, and it's not considered, as a bit of trivia, an actual XML element. The doctype element, though, is something that you may have seen in other types of documents. Where might you have seen this doctype thing before? Yeah, so HTML 4.01 documents, XHTML 1.0 strict or transitional documents tend or are required these days to have this doctype declaration that essentially associates with the document a DTD, a document type definition. In the context of XHTML or HTML, if you associate with an HTML document the specific doctype element that the W3C has said, this is what you must put at the top of an HTML 4.01 compliant document. What that tells a parser, a program that reads that HTML file, is that it should validate it against the W3C specification, or in our speak, recommendation for HTML 4.01. These days, most browsers are pretty forgiving, so even if you put the thing up there and you make some mistakes in the document and include, like, the blink tag, which is not in the W3C specification, the browser's not going to report an error and not show you the page. It's going to ignore it. So browsers, realize, are very forgiving when it comes to errors in syntax these days. But in an XML document, it is, in fact, very important. Because what you did not see, for instance, in that XML RPC demonstration was really any guarantee that the data coming in on the wire was properly formatted. I was sort of just trusting on the server's end that if I receive a transmission, it had hopefully better line up with one of the methods that David implemented in that wormboyd.java file. Recall I said, hey, when you receive a transmission, your default behavior should be call the method that is like named. Well, unfortunately, that means I could ship across the wire from any client in the world an HTTP transaction with a bunch of XML that if it has bogus RPC data in it, the server's probably going to crash or it's going to report an error. But generally, it's just hoping that the data is going to be formatted as it expects. But enter the world of doc types. Now you can specify at the top of an XML document that this document should conform or does conform to a DTD, document type definition, which we'll look at in a couple of weeks, but in short, it's just a specification of what the document should look like. If it has a student element, what should be in a student element? If it has an ID attribute, what should the value of that attribute be? An integer, a string, that sort of thing. This is related to XML schema, which is another form of validation that we'll get to in the future. This too is, though, optional, need not be at the top of a file, but if you want to be able to enforce and affect typing, a type system in XML, whether it's in RPC or just on a local system, the doctypef declaration allows us to do that. What this particular one implies is you can kind of infer, what do you think this doctype declaration up the very top right is telling the XML parser or the program that receives this representative document? Perfect. What that means is use the file called students.dtd, which is presumably in your current working directory on the local system, hence system in all capitals, starting with what element? Students. So what you do is you specify the root elements of the document, and you say from that point on down, validate according to whatever's in students.dtd. We'll look at a students.dtd or the like, again, in a few lectures' times. Yeah?
How much should we invest in learning the language then? It seems like you're saying that it's the original mechanism, but it seems to be not.
So we will visit DTD in much greater detail in Lecture 8. It is the older form of validation for XML documents, but it's also the much quicker and dirtier approach to validation and is probably to this day the more popular and common one, more common than XML schema. If only because it's so much quicker and easier to write up. So we'll see. And we'll certainly introduce in class the syntax that is useful for something like that. So now we get to the juicy stuff, the stuff that actually is open bracket, close bracket. XML documents always have at least one element. So that element we said last week is called the root document, and an XML document can have only one root element. In this case, it was students. Exactly. Students was the particular root element. Here's another one, though, excerpted from that document. You would say collectively that what I've highlighted in gray there is a name element. A name element syntactically is made up of a start tag and a close tag, or start tag and an end tag, and we talked about that last week, open tag, close tag, but it's everything nested inside of that. An element is, in effect, everything nested inside of it, and we'll see in due time that an element can actually be hierarchical and is sort of a branch of a tree and everything beneath it. But the element itself can also be said, as we'll look at in our lecture on DOM next week, can just be a node in a tree as well. So we'll come back to that. So a start tag, as you know from HTML, can have zero or more attributes. In HTML and XHTML, only certain attributes are allowed. In XML, you can put anything there that you want, unless you're required to conform to like a DTD. But if it's your own document, you can have zero or more attributes. Relevant in this case is that the name of a XML element must start with a letter or underscore, and thereafter can only contain letters, numbers, hyphens, periods, and underscores. So relatively limited in the types of tokens you can use for the name, worth bearing in mind. Notice that it cannot begin with what? Numbers, which is kind of a nuisance, but it is nonetheless the reality. Attributes, meanwhile, if they appear, must be flanked in quotes, as we discussed last week, whether double quotes or single quotes, and they are case sensitive, certainly when we get to DTDs and schemas. Okay? A few different types of elements content. So an element can be this hierarchical structure, because between the open tag and closed tag, you can have some content. In that last example, we had content of Joe Bob. In the representative document itself, there's a whole bunch of stuff nested between the student's open tag and the student's closed tag. So what kind of content can an XML element be said to have? Well, it can have element content, and we see that in our representative document. The student's element, it doesn't just have Joe Bob right after open student's tag, but rather it has nested inside of it a status tag and perhaps some other stuff from our representative document. You can also have what's called PC data inside of an element. So the contents of an element can just be parsed character data. It's parsed in the sense that the parser, or again, the program reading this document, is going to look at it and make sure you don't have any illegal characters. We talked briefly about this last week. What was one illegal character last week? Ampersand one, and not end tag. The open tag. Yes, the less than sign or the open tag. So if you have a field that's defined to be PC data, parsed character data, it had better not contain illegal characters, because they will be parsed and ergo mistaken for something that they are not, an open tag, a less than sign for an open tag. Mixed content. Mixed content means it can be a little bit of both. You can have some PC data, maybe nested inside of that. You can have some element data as well, element content. Or, of course, you can have no content at all. In HTML or XHTML, there are certain tags that don't require closed tags, per se, such as space, to be more specific. What do you mean by space?
White space.
White space, but give me an actual tag that can be opened and simultaneously closed, for instance. Image?
Paragraph?
The BR. The paragraph tag, more properly, should be open and closed, but the BR tag, for instance, in HTML, usually rather lazily, is always written as that, but in XHTML should be written as something like that. Headings like H1 and H2, well, those two should be closed. Otherwise, your whole document will be H1 or H2 or the like. Right? So in short, in XML, an XHTML, recall, is simply an XML-compliant version of HTML, in effect. No content means that you open it and close it in the same breath. Or it would be equivalent, as we'll see in XML, to write something like this, even with the open and close tag. But if you have not so much as a space in between them, that too would be considered no content.
If you have a no content tag, can you assume that writing the equivalent is correct? Or that is, could you have dorm closed tag, or could you have open tag dorm, open tag closed tag dorm in the same place? I mean, is it changeable in that way, or do you have to make sure that?
Good question. So is it equivalent, really, if I can rephrase slightly, to write this or that?
Right.
It depends, as is often the case with all these kinds of questions. If your document is white space sensitive, whereby you don't want to throw away white space, even though it might make the document human readable, but is actually useful white space, and there happened to be a space in there, well, then you couldn't collapse it to this. The means by which you enforce such white space constraints, we'll see and we'll discuss briefly in Project 1, is by way of DTDs or XML schemas. So the short answer is it depends. Usually it would be fine to collapse it into this. And in fact, upon reading an XML document, if you did what's called, quote unquote, serializing it back out to standard output, reading a document in and then maybe spitting it back out to a new file, the parser could make that judgment call and just collapse the tag to this, simply to be more efficient or pretty. What is the use of no content? Looks a little silly there, but give me someone else answer that than me.
Is it for the format
You could certainly use it if for the formatting of the content. Can you elaborate?
It's the way it appears when you read the content. So,
sure. So from a user's point of view, this is a useful syntax to support. Again, consider XHTML. It makes sense for the BR tag. It makes sense for the image tag. Now, the BR tag just is open bracket, BR, close bracket. Image tag has some other stuff. I'm sorry?
Source,
more generally called attributes and values. So even though an XML element doesn't have to have children or text nested inside of it, it can absolutely have attributes and values and still be said to have no content. Attributes, values are not considered content in this hierarchical sense. And those are absolutely valuable. In fact, attributes, let's just toss a couple of useful tidbits about them forward. Name. So it, too, must start with a letter or underscore and can only contain what we enumerated earlier. The value is less restrictive. A value can be of several different types, which we'll come back to briefly when our discussion of DTD in Lecture 8, but usually is just a string of some sort. There really isn't strong typing imposed on attributes values, at least with regard to DTD. They must be quoted. So two valid uses of an attribute value pair might be title equals quote unquote lecture two, completely legitimate, or match equals single quote, item equals double quote, baseball bat, close double quote, close single quote. That is valid. So like in other languages, you can intermingle these two so long as you keep things balanced, but you couldn't go one step further and add more quotes after that because then you would confuse the parser. So that, though, would be correct. And here's the gotcha. Similarly, can the values of attributes not themselves contain these two illegal characters? Those are pretty much the only two usually problematic characters in XML. But as in most languages, there are ways around that. Well, what's PC data? JimBob. JimBob is considered parsed character data. It's parsed character data in the sense that by definition, we want to allow the parser to actually parse this, make sure it doesn't contain any legal characters, and then actually send it through. So whatever application wants to receive the post-parsed XML documents. But it too cannot contain those two illegal characters. And it can reference, as I say here, entities, which is a perfect segue to this. And this is another bit of XML trivia that can cost you a bit of time late at night and induce a bit of headbanging if you forget it. But let me draw attention to the fact now that NBSP is not a predefined entity in XML. Okay, you don't get that one for free. The only predefined entities that you get in XML, and an entity is something that starts with an ampersand and ends with a semicolon and has either a numeric string or an alphabetic string in between, or alphanumeric, is ampersand, less than, greater than, apostrophe, and quote. Those are the only five nicknames that you have for what you would otherwise just type off of a keyboard, but must be can be expressed with entities. And two of those are absolutely useful. If you didn't have ampersand, AMP, semicolon, you could never have a literal ampersand in a document. And think on this when we get to, I think, project two, when the name, I believe, AT&T will crop up in a data file and will cause you a bit of angst, perhaps, if you forget to bear that in mind. And less than, of course, is a useful thing to be able to express. But as we'll see in XPath, the requirement that you use an entity instead of a literal less than starts to look a little strange when, as last week, you're writing mathematical formulae that don't actually have less than but have this crazy thing inside of it. But entities are essentially like macros or escape sequences. It allows you to define sort of a shorthand notation for expressing some other string. The means by which you declare an entity is like this. So I could paste this line here at the top of my XML file, and what that essentially does in the spirit of like a sharp define in C or C++ is it aliases NBSP, or more specifically ampersand, NBSP semicolon, to this literal sequence. This here is a decimal sequence indicating a UTF-8 character, which if you look it up in a nice ASCII chart or Unicode chart, you will see is actually a space character. So remember that, a useful copy-paste. They cannot, it's not recursive. You can't have an entity reference itself since that creates some bad things. This, for instance, might be the entity you could write, and I don't have a long enough finger tonight, to say ampersand sharp X00A9 semicolon. Well, that's equivalent to the copyright character. I'm sorry.
With C data?
With C data, character data, which appears in attributes values, it is not allowed to appear there. The only place it is allowed to, PC data. In C data sections, which we'll actually highlight the syntax of in a moment, that is okay because they are not by definition parsed, so you can put anything that you actually want in there without a problem. C data. So in the event that you really need to stick something in an XML document and you can't make it conform or it wouldn't make sense to make it conform, you can escape it. You can escape it in its entirety. You do this with the rather cryptic syntax that, frankly, it took me 2 years to actually remember that it's open bracket, exclamation point, open square bracket, C data, open square bracket, dot, 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 close square bracket, close angle bracket. Okay, that is the escape sequence. Anything you put betwixt those two sequences of characters will not be parsed by an XML parser, will be passed through literally. So you can put most anything you want in there, including things like open bracket, H1, close bracket, actual HTML markup that you want to be outputted quite literally. Yeah. Oh, let's go here and then here. It is different from strings that are commented out in that this content will be passed to whatever application requested that a document be parsed. So this typical sequence of events, as we'll see tonight, is this. You're writing some software, maybe a little mail application, that is storing its preferences in a XML file. Its configuration file is XML. My mail application doesn't want to implement an XML parser. I want to use an off-the-shelf product like Xerxes, which we'll also see tonight, that just parses that document for me and hands me back a Java object, which is essentially a hash table or a tree that embodies whatever the content of that XML file was. If I put comments in that file, in the HTML sense, open bracket, exclamation point, dash, dash, those comments are thrown away. Those are only for humans' eyes. C data sections are stripped of the open bracket, exclamation point, and so forth text, but the raw content in between those cryptic sequences are passed back to my application, so I can do with them as I will. Good question.
Doesn't that have the same problem with closed square bracket, or is it only the closing little square bracket, greater than only count the end of the line? How do they deal with that problem?
If you want to include a square bracket, greater than sign, you would have to do square bracket, ampersand, GT, semicolon. So it looks for those three characters in a row. Okay. But you could still generate those three characters. So it should not, if I recall correctly, choke on square bracket for that reason, because if you're missing, it uses a look-ahead buffer, presumably, of three characters. And if it doesn't get to the end and see it, you're okay. This is annoying, and fortunately, most people will never have to say open bracket, exclamation point, C data, but it's a weird thing. So, comments, finally. You're familiar with these probably from HTML, XHTML. They exist in XML as well, and as I just said, even earlier than I intended to, they do not get passed through to your application. The parser can throw them away altogether. They are literally meant for humans' eyes alone. They, with that said, can be passed through to an application, but there's no guarantee of that. It depends on the API that you happen to be using. Okay, finally, processing instructions. This was one of the last tags that we did not look at yet that were at the top of that representative XML document. And these are admittedly a little strange. These are meant to be usually processing instructions. In other words, these are meant to be pieces of data that are included in an XML file that provide hints to the XML parser as to how to behave. They are arbitrarily formatted for the most part. A processing instruction, by definition, begins with open bracket, question mark, PI name, PI processing instruction. So you give it a name. The value of a PI is literally everything that follows, not parsed in any sense. So what people will typically do, and this, I think, is rather sloppy, is as follows. They will often create the illusion of including in a PI a key value pair, an attribute value pair, but what my application will be handed is not an attribute called display description and a value equals true. My application will be handed a literal string that is display DASC equals quote unquote true. my application then would have to parse that string itself. So they're of limited value, I think. We'll see one use of these when we get to XSLT. You can, using just Internet Explorer, actually apply XSLT style sheets to XML documents simply by embedding something like that at the top of the file. So they do have their uses, but the format is a little arbitrary and a little frustrating in that there's no syntax imposed. But as we say here, sticky notes of sorts that are usually hints, by no means required in a document, not that common, arguably, that help the application out in some sense. Questions on the basic building blocks of XML? That's sort of open bracket, close bracket, exploded into 10 or so more slides. Well, let me make two administrative announcements. As mentioned over an email this week, we'll begin with sections tonight. Because of folks' commute and so forth, it seems like it will be safest and best simply to run sections after lectures each week. What we will do tonight is, after this, I'll put on my section hat instead, and things will be much more casual. I won't try to come across as so formal. I'll actually stand down at your level. And that'll be in Emerson 106, which is probably somewhere down this hall. In sections, things will be more hands-on, more practical, more project-oriented, more casual in terms of not presentation of new material, but rather we can rehash some of the material that we do that night or in a previous night. We'll do a code walkthrough, usually, of the code, hence my suggestion that you bring this along tonight, where I'll try to point out, even as with specific line numbers, what might be good to look at. So they're by no means required or necessary, but a lot of students find them helpful, certainly as useful starting points for the project so that you have a bit more guidance as to where to go. For those of you that can't stick around, or for those of you that are tuning in remotely, what we will do is record the audio of these sections as well, and I'll try to make profuse note of line numbers and so forth so that you can still follow along with them at home. And in that same spirit, what we will begin doing this coming week is podcasting the audio portion of the lectures and the sections so that you can not only take E259 with you on your computer at home, but on a jog or on a commute or on your iPod and listen to me on the MBTA, dare say. So with that said, we actually did this in Computer Science E1, which was the course I introduced you to tonight, and it actually worked quite well from students' feedback, if only as a useful mechanism to review content, or if you miss a lecture for whatever reason, it's just yet a more portable format. So there'll be downloadable MP3s via iTunes and the website itself. Any questions administratively or otherwise? No? All right, why don't we take a 5-minute break, help yourself to candy. There's drinks in the soda machine downstairs, bathroom downstairs, and we'll resume about 35 after. All right, so we are back, and now we get to get our hands dirty with some actual code. First, we need to give you a bit of background on the first of two programmatic interfaces that we'll focus on tonight and next week, to XML, and what do I mean by that? Well, you have an XML document, foo.xml, sitting on your local file system. One of the upsides of XML is that you yourself, subsequent to Project 1 at least, will never have to parse that document yourself. You will never have to deal with the nuances of checking if you have an open bracket, a double quote, a single quote, an equal sign. All of that will be handled for you using some kind of parser. A parser now is simply a program that reads some document and then behaves accordingly, usually responding to an application that requested use of that parser with salient information about the document. So again, to pick an arbitrary example, I'm writing in a little email client, and I want to be able to parse my configuration file, pine.xml, if you will, in my local directory, and I want the parser to inform me of all of the key value pairs that are effectively embedded in that document, all of the attributes, the values, the elements, and so forth. Well, how can I get that information back? Well, even if you've never heard the term DOM before I used it tonight and last week, document object model, you can sort of tell just from the indentation of XML alone that there's this hierarchy to it, a tree of some sort. After all, the root of the document is called a root element. Nested inside of a root element, we saw in our representative document, per our discussion last week too, were things called child elements, which themselves can have children, and so forth. So obvious might be a tree. So you might call an XML parser, say, go parse my configuration file, return to me the in-memory representation of it. Well, what might that representation be? Well, the most obvious one might be some kind of tree, a singly rooted tree with some kind of arbitrary structure hanging beneath it. Tree in the sense of any data structures class you might have taken. or any tree structure you might have used. Well, that is often useful, especially if you want to traverse the document and access arbitrary parts of it and grab arbitrary data at different points during your execution. But what might a downside be to a parser returning to you a tree representation of your XML document?
It's large.
It's large, right? It probably doesn't scale all that well for very large XML documents because for each element, you might imagine, you have to instantiate an object, a node of some sort. And memory allocation in and of itself tends not to be ideal to be doing it all the time, so that alone might incur a bit of latency. Just allocating the memory itself can be expensive, especially for a large object. Moreover, not all applications need that information lying around in memory throughout the program's execution. A configuration file, after all, can probably grab that information, make use of it, and then forget about it, or at least retain it in its own local variable. Certainly doesn't need a whole tree sitting around in memory if you only need the config file at startup and not throughout execution. So the first of the programmatic interfaces we'll look at then is called SAX, Simple API for XML. And this is in contrast to next week's API, which is DOM, the Document Object Model. SAX is a sort of fire and forget API. If you use a SAX parser to read an XML document on your behalf, what you're telling the parser to do is as follows. Read the document from top to bottom, and every time you encounter something interesting in that document, call a method, call an event handler to inform me of that item of interest. What's an item of interest? The start of an element, the end of an element, a chunk of character data, the start of a comment, the start of a processing instruction, any of these sort of remarkable, sort of macroscopic events, entity-based events, you want to be informed about via some kind of callback. So what SAX requires that you do is implement, in order to use a SAX parser, what's called a content handler. If you want a SAX parser to read your document for you, well, you have to tell that parser what methods to call back upon discovery of remarkable events, the start of an element, the end of an element. Those methods that you pass to the parser are collectively wrapped up in what's called a content handler, an object that has implementations of all of the methods you want called in an event-based manner. And here is how SAX might work. Suppose that our XML document looks as follows. We'll keep it quite simple just to get the point across. So this is a sample document. It has a root element of students. Nested inside of that is a child element called student. It is a no content element, but it does have an attribute, an ID of 0001. Then we have a close students tag. Well, how might we parse this in this event-based SAX model? Well, what is the very first thing to be encountered upon the parsing of this document? What is the first remarkable event after you effectively call fopen, open a file handle? You're opening the file, and we'll call generally an XML file, an XML document. So the first event to be fired is called in the SAX API start document, which, to be clear, if you want to use a SAX handler, you better implement a method called start document and pass that to the SAX parser so that he knows what method to call. Okay, what is the next thing that we're going to encounter in our representative document? And try to focus more up here so it's a bit of an intellectual engagement rather than telling me what I wrote last night. Start
element.
Okay, start element. Why? What's the key to that? Well, the first character you're going to notice is open bracket students. I spent a lot of time on the little animations here. It's one of the few cases in which PowerPoint animation is actually useful in some sense. So that's the first remarkable event. Start document followed by start element. Start element, though, in the SAX API takes two arguments, the first of which is the name of the element, and the second of which is essentially a linked list or an array of attributes. Well, what is the first attribute we're about to parse? The next thing we're about to parse is close bracket. So what does that indicate to you? It's the end of the element. Back up. It's not the end of the element. Right, we're going to read something next. Well, there's no attributes associated, so I'm going to finish this breath in the content handler view of our world. But what's the next event handler that's going to be called? Well, literally, what appears in the document after that angled bracket? A new line. So backslash n, followed by backslash t, or maybe space, 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 something like that. Well, let's take a look. All right, so we have an open bracket. As soon as we see that open bracket, because it's sort of a special character in XML, we know that everything prior to that was sort of an event in its entirety of interest. In this case, it was the characters, new line, followed by a few single white spaces. So characters is another event that is defined in the SACS API.
So it only knows that there was a new line after it actually is relevant?
Correct.
So you have to put that in.
If there were a new line character there, then it would parse it as follows. And what most parsers will do is grab the largest chunk of contiguous characters and return all of those in the form of a call to characters. However, annoying as this might be, that's not a guarantee. It would be completely consistent with the spec to call characters 5 times, each with a parameter of 1 character. Sort of a nuisance for you, the application, if you then yourself have to reassemble the data, but that is the way the spec is written. In this case, the parser, or in this case, me, happen to write it all as one event, which tends to be more common, but also more useful, but not something you can necessarily trust. I'm about to read more characters. I've just read an open bracket. The next thing to come in across the wire is going to be the name of the element. So I know that I can now call a start element, the name of which is student. This time it's a little more interesting because this thing does, in fact, have an attribute value. So I can now fill in this attributes object, this linked list, in effect, of that tuple. So we have a key value pair in effect. And this is just, this itself, to be clear, is not strict Java syntax, because you can't really just write this as I am, more of a pseudocode for the sake of discussion for now. The next thing to be read is that close bracket and end tag in effect. So what's next going to be called? End element is in fact called practically in the same breath, right after the start element call, because there's no content to that element. The next thing to be parsed? Good. So the new line character, no tabs or spaces this time because it was left flushed. Okay, but we start to read the next tag's name, slash students, which indicates an element. Good. And document is the last one to be called. So that is the representative sequence of methods that would be called if you used a SACS parser to parse your document. And to be clear, it would be you who's implementing each of these methods, start document, start elements, and characters, so that you, the programmer, get to decide what do you do when you encounter this particular element. What do you do when you encounter the end of that particular element? So let's take a look at an actual example. Question back here, then here.
Given that white space is supposed to be irrelevant to XML, why does the SACS parser tell you about
it? So your claim is that white space is irrelevant to XML. White space is irrelevant to XML only if the DTD or schema associated with it says it is relevant. In the absence of a DTD or schema, tends to be irrelevant. But only once you actually specify some structure with the DTD or schema do you actually have some guarantees as to whether the white space should remain or whether it should be thrown out. So for the often it's thrown out, but you can certainly impose a requirement that it is required and should not be thrown out. And you'll spend a bit of time on this in actually Project 1. Question here first, then John. Sure. So yes, so if I had, did they give me a laser pointer? Yep. Well, that's a strange laser pointer. All right, so if we had the word dog here arbitrarily, what would happen is that DOG would be in this character's call, or maybe in a call unto itself, but it would be in this point in our timeline.
And then we have
DOG / n space 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 space, and that's it. John?
Would an XML file just everything beyond one line?
Everything beyond one line? I'm not sure I follow.
In other words, not have any new line characters.
Oh, absolutely. So an XML file does not need to have any of these new line characters. And in fact, if we recall that when I showed you with the packet sniffer, in effect, what my RPC call was, it was just one huge XML string. And I pasted it into that program stylus just so that I could click its cute little button that indented everything for me.
That sort of confuses me why you're
defining characters as though they have some meaning to XML.
So they have meaning to the... If a white space appears in the document, the parser will not throw it away unless you tell it it can throw it away via a DTD or schema. XML will assume that if you don't tell it otherwise, that that white space is important, because it would be rather bold of the API to just throw away your white space without a say from you. So by default, XML will assume that white space is significant. If you want to tell it that, hey, not significant, really just there for humans' benefit, you do that with a DTD or schema. But otherwise, the fact that in my document I have written a new line character in a few spaces, XML will not take it upon itself. Sacks will not take it upon itself to throw that away unless I explicitly permit it.
I don't know how seriously I should look at this, but if I were to write a parser, for example, you have start document, and then after that, the first thing I would look for is the left bracket. I would say get left bracket, then get name, then get right bracket. Very different than what you've done here.
That's true, but what we are showing you is the Sacks API, what happens. What you will explore in Project 1 is what you just described, the actual implementation of the methods that tokenize this input and realize, oh, this is an element, I must therefore call the start element routine. So what we just did, we did not write a parser. We wrote a content handler for an XML parser. When I want to, writing my mail program, access my configuration file, I instantiate a little black box of an XML parser, and I say, you know what, parse this document however you know how. In your case, John, you're proposing look for the angle bracket, then read the element name. And that might be how the XML parser is working. But what we're looking at is what the XML parser is handing back. The Sacks API has the XML parser, upon its discovery of interesting things in the document, execute these callback functions that we have provided him references to by way of a content handler object. And I'll hopefully make this more clear in just one moment with some actual code. Yeah. Okay.
If you were to pass this bit of quite predefined, you know, ampersand other stuff,
okay,
in the characters, you just pass it as ampersand AMP, or you want to pass it as a character?
If you... Okay, so if there were an ampersand that appeared
in my value students.
Okay.
The characters are passed as ampersand.
The characters are ampersand, it would be resolved to whatever it represents for the user or for the application processing it. But usually those are alphanumeric code, so it depends on the form in which you get your string back. Sure. What it will be, and we'll see in a second, it's just going to be a null reference. So that's what I sort of am implying by my pseudocode here. Open squiggly, close squiggly with nothing in it. It just means it's a null object. There are no attributes.
It's not possible to pass
it. Well, no, you would just pass in the Java implementation of this null. Forging ahead? Okay, now we get to the juicy stuff, because we can actually take a look at a piece of code. In fact, one of tonight's two handouts is this handout, a code excerpt, line numbered, as usual, called saxdemo.java. All of this code, to be clear, is available on the FAS NICE system, as well as linked on the course's website, so you can download it to your FAS accounts via SSH, or you can also just download it via your browser to your local machine. What I've done is copied this code over to my own personal account so that we can take a look at saxdemo.java. Is the text of this font big enough? Okay. So let's take a look. What Sacks Demo does is it makes use of a few different packages and classes, all of which are part of JAXP. JAXP is just the Java API for XML processing. This is a standard set of APIs that, in fact, is now incorporated into the JDK by Sun Microsystems. So if you download Java 1.5, you actually get an implementation of JAXP 1.3. If you download Java 1.4.2, you get a slightly older implementation of JAXP, but it is built into the standard API these days, at least most of it in 1.4.2 and all of it in 1.5. But we'll walk you through the process in Project 1 of actually downloading the implementations that you actually need so that you have the latest versions. The Java JDK from Sun actually shipped with older versions of the parser and XSLT processor, tend to be buggy, not as good, so we always override those implementations anyway. Xerces, though, is perhaps the de facto standard in XML parsers for Java implementations, and for better or for worse, Java is perhaps the most popular language, or certainly among the most popular languages for the processing of XML, but that's sort of starting to change, especially with the popularity of web services and XML RPC calls, where you really are getting language independence as more people are spending time implementing libraries that people like me can just download and make use of. So it is rather language independent, but Xerces is a very robust, performance-oriented, freely available from the Apache project XML parser. And it supports both the SACS API as well as the DOM API. The relevant packages and classes to tonight's demos are these, and frankly, I think they're best explained not so much by looking at the Java doc, but by looking at some actual sample code. And that sample code here is saxdemo.java. Notice that just to get a high-level view of this file, what I have is a main routine. It's quite a simple file. I have a main routine that's first just checking how many arguments are passed in, because what I want this to be, I want this to be executed at the command line with saxdemo space file name, where file name is the name of an XML file that I want to parse using the SACS API that we just discussed on a pseudocode and conceptual level. So these first several lines of code, just boring Java details. Grab the name of the file. Here's the interesting part. What I want this demo to do is try to instantiate a SACS parser. The two lines of copy-paste boilerplate code with which you can do that for a SACS parser are these. And provided on FAS, you have your account configured as the project specifies, or on your own local machine. You configure your machine as the project specifies. This will just work, assuming you've added things to your class path according to the document appropriately. To actually now run our demo, I am just going to instantiate a SACS demo object. So what am I then doing with the reference, which I've called handler? I am calling the parser object, which again I instantiated here, parse routine. So this is a method that's in the SACS parser class's definition, and then I'm passing it two parameters, one, the name of the file, and then a reference to this handler. So when I said earlier on a high level that what you do when you use the SACS API is you, your application, instantiate a SACS parser and hand that parser a suite of methods to call you back via, well, that's exactly what I'm doing here. The standard interface via which you provide these callback methods to an XML parser are via what's called a content handler. So what we're doing now with this demonstration is trying to tease apart some of the useful features of the JAXP API, which again is Java API for XML processing. That is the kitchen sink of XML processing. Anything you want to do with XML and Java is included in this API, including SACS. So notice that one of the imports I made at the top of this file, again, boilerplate code that for the most part early in the semester copy-paste this kind of stuff until you get comfortable with it, is a content handler, which is defined in the SACS API and which is implemented via the JDK's implementation of JAXP. But I'm using a lot of words just to state very simple ideas. The code's already implemented for you. So where is this content handler? Well, it's not quite clear, but notice that my SACS demo class, an object of which we instantiate and thereafter pass to the parser as a handler, is extending what? So it's extending default handler. Well, default handler also appears up here, but all this time I've been mentioning content handler, and this seems to be some kind of helper. Well, what's going on? Well, one of the most useful APIs that you'll make use of this semester is linked, as are all the others, under resources. The first section of this page is relevant APIs, one for Xerces, one for Xalen, one for Java itself, one for the servlet aspect of J2EE, and then the second one for JAXP. If you click on this API spec, you'll get the Java doc. What I'm going to do is click over to the default handler class, because my class is clearly extending this class that someone else implemented, and notice that this class called default handler implements, among other things, what? Content handler. So content handler is a Java interface. And for those of you who are a little new to Java, and maybe you've only taken E50A or B, you might not be so savvy with the notion of interfaces and extending and so forth. It's all quite easy. Simply chat with me after class or during section or over email or in person. Not hard to pick up, but essentially a content handler is an interface in the sense that it prescribes a set of methods that anyone who implements this interface must in turn implement. Specifically, if you are implementing the content handler class, guess what methods you need to provide implementations of? Start document, start element, characters. We've seen all these, we've seen some of these before. Default handler, meanwhile, as suggested here, implements that interface. Well, what does it mean, default handler? Well, if you were simply to write, if I were to have written this demo in the most formal sense, I would not extend default handler, I would implement content handler. But then that would have been kind of a nuisance, especially for a lecture demo, which is meant to boil the complexity down to something more simple, because if you implement an interface, you don't get to pick and choose which methods you implement. Which ones do you implement? All of them. And if only because that would get sloppy and then draw unnecessary attention to start prefix mapping, which is not something you'll likely ever need this semester, if ever. Rather, I simply extended default handler, which is a class that Sun Microsystems implemented. It's part of the SAX helpers package that all it does is it implements every one of those methods, including start prefix, start prefix mapping, but it implements them in the quickest, dirtiest way possible. It's just null implementation. So they exist, but they don't do anything. And this is a nice Java trick often when you want to implement most of an interface, but not all of it. You don't care about the behavior of the rest, so it tends to be easier to just extend one of these null implementations of an interface, because now you can just override the behavior of the methods you care about. And that's precisely what I do. Notice that though the important call in my main routine is this parse routine, the parse routine proceeds to parse the document, however Apache has decided to implement a parser. Maybe as John described earlier, look for the left bracket, look for the start element name, and so forth. We don't care, though. It's a black box to us. But what it's designed to do, the SAX parser, is to call any of the methods in this content handler that are appropriate during the parsing process. One of them is start document. So what I have done for this demonstration is I have overridden the default behavior of the start document method. Default in the sense that the default handler's implementation does nothing, certainly nothing of interest. So I've overridden it, said, you know what, don't call this version, extend that class, and rather call this version. And what is my demo clearly going to do when the start document method is called? It's just going to print out start document. Pretty trivial. And that's kind of all you need to do, but you'll see in Project 1 that sometimes this might be the point at which you want to instantiate an actual object, like the root of a tree, because you're beginning to build a document. And that's precisely what you wind up doing. Well, what do I do for start element? Well, start element is a little uglier, but there's no magic here. There's no XML content here. This is just some Java syntax so that I can print out, quote unquote, start element, and then I can print out, in effect, a recreation of this pseudocode. So what this demo is going to do is spit out what I effectively later copy-pasted here. So let's take a look further. What about end element? Well, my implementation of that, not surprisingly, just says end element, just to get the point across. Characters, meanwhile, characters is interesting only insofar as the SAX API, if you looked closely at the Java doc, would notice it doesn't take a string as input. Rather, it takes a character array. But it gets a index of the start elements in that array, and then it gets the total length. And this is a performance trick so that it can hand you a much bigger array than you need if it's been reading it into a buffer, but it says, hey, just start looking at it at this point in the array. So with just a little bit of Java here, I convert that array to a string, and I print it out too. Again, this is just sort of a little utility I wanted to implement. And the similar methods are implemented similarly, so I'm going to go ahead and compile this, which on Nice is almost always as simple as doing something like that, once you've configured yourself per Project 1. Now, notice that I have a saxdemo.class file. So, Java saxdemo. Okay, all right, I executed it incorrectly because it needs to take a name. Oh, I got some sample files that I borrowed from Project 1. We gave you 8 sample files, the first of which, 1.xml. Pretty simple file. Hopefully this demo will work on this. So what I'm going to do is run Java of Sachs demo on samples XML1. And what it prints out is that pseudocode syntax that we used in our discussion earlier. But what has literally happened is my content handler, or my extension of the default handler's implementation of the content handler interface, to say it quite verbosely, called these 4 methods. What I implemented those methods to do is just to print out their own names and a bit of their parameterization, just for sort of the sake of discussion. Now, fundamentally, not a useful product that we just implemented, right? We just parsed an XML document and pretty much spit it back out with a bit more metadata, but demonstrates use of the Sachs API. And that, hopefully, is the takeaway. What you'll see in Project 1, then, is, among other things, is you will implement, in order to build a tree, a Sachs handler that, upon calling a start element method, what do you think you have to do? If you're trying to build a tree out of an XML document, and occasionally start element is called, what do you probably have to do every time start element is called? In the interest of building up this tree, sort of element by element by element, you probably want to create an object and remember that element, so you instantiate a new node, as we'll call it next week, and you fill it with the name of the element, maybe a reference to its attributes or whatever, maybe a linked list of its children, and then you recurse and continue to build up accordingly. But more on DOM next week. Tonight's focus is more on the first of these API. So questions on some of this code?
When you construct the parser, you use the parser factory.
Yep.
What does that buy you, having a factory instead of constructing the parser directly?
So the factory mechanism is becoming increasingly popular so that you can modularize implementations of these different types of classes. When you churn out a factory and then call new Sachs parser, what you are effectively able to do here is you can override, for instance, what kind of parser the factory is going to spit out by way of Java system properties or by what's called Sun's endorsed overrides mechanism. You can affect what kind of objects are spit out. It gives you one additional layer of abstraction so that, yes, you're spitting out a Sachs parser, but you don't have to hard code into your code the specific implementation name of it. It doesn't have to be Apache's parser. It doesn't have to be the Saxon parser. But you can abstract away and just call it a Sachs parser. And in the factory is where you actually hook it or associate it with a specific implementation. And Project 1 will actually walk you through the process of ensuring that the one you're using isn't the one that comes with the JDK, but the very latest from Apache. The alternative, too, would be if the JDK shipped with a class called Sachs parser, but it was buggy, it was slow, and you wanted to override it, ripping that code out of the JDK and then inserting your own class called Sachs parser, non-trivial with a distribution like that. So the factory method lets you be more modularized and plug things in, pull them out. Pretty common for certainly this kind of stuff. And notice, just for kicks, what I'll often do in lecture demos, just so that we have enough debugging information, is things like this. This is not really an elegant way to handle a problem in your code, but for debugging purposes and lecture purposes, just by printing a stack trace sort of helps us look at the code. So don't read too much into best practices when sometimes it's meant to highlight code, not necessarily say how to handle your errors. And as an aside, too, I cannot stress enough the value of JavaDoc. Certainly with the world of XML, in particular this course, I think it's boring for me to spend much time introducing the class to, here's the characters event. It takes 4 parameters or 3 parameters. And that gets very boring very quickly. So what we'll try to do in lectures, rather, is draw out the most relevant or interesting aspects of the code, usually by way of commented examples, often with pointers or hand waves at some of the Java doc, but it would absolutely be expected, just for programming in general, but certainly for this course, that if you're curious as to how the characters method works or what one of those parameters means, pull up the Java doc. And it's very well documented, the JaxP interface, so Java doc is your friend when it comes to this stuff. We'll give you usually just enough to get the job done, but hopefully with enough of a desire to go see what else you could do, what else exists in this particular API or class. Well, looking then toward project one. So parsing very quickly means essentially to parse, in our context, to divide a stream of data up into logical components. So XML, an XML document, is really just a stream of characters that in and of themselves mean nothing. But according to the XML recommendation, if you view that document through the lens of XML, an open bracket has some special significance. A double quote followed by a string followed by another double quote has some special significance. An equal sign tends to have some special significance. So the process of parsing a document means to interpret those various items of interest in a document and sort of behave accordingly. So it means more formally, read an XML document, identify these various items of interest, and then make it available in some form to an application. How do we make it available? Well, we've seen tonight how to make it available via the SACS API. We'll see next week how to make it available via a DOM API. So how do we know how to parse a document? Well, XML is defined via a grammar. If you've taken a theory of computation course or a programming languages course, you're probably familiar with languages or grammars, perhaps those in BNF or Backus Naur form, which is just a familiar format, hopefully, that just defines with left-hand sides and right-hand sides and an equal sign in the middle what strings you can generate using some basic building blocks. And I'll defer this to an at-home mental parsing because I think it's best explained by a simple example. This is a grammar in BNF form which simply tells you that there are these non-terminals, as we'll call them, EQN, term, OP, and value, which are like variables, if you will, non-terminal variables. On the right-hand side of the equal sign, you have a rule that says an equation is made up, in this case, of a term followed by a literal equal sign followed by another term. And the capitalized words here, because they're not quoted, mean this is, you got to do some sort of recursive or iterative substitution. So what is a term? Well, a term is a literal parenthesis followed by another term followed by an operator followed by another term followed by a literal parenthesis, or it's just a raw value. Well, what's a value? Well, value is any number. Well, what's an operator? An operator is either a literal plus or minus or divide or multiply. With this grammar, then, you can generate expressions like this. Basic grade school arithmetic expressions. What, then, is the value of all this complexity? What can you do with something so formal as this when it's clearly obvious to the human, you know, what an arithmetic expression is?
It's
not ambiguous, certainly not, and it's also formalized so that exactly you can feed it to a computer, or in a sense, you can feed it to a developer who can use a computer to implement a parser for that language. One of the first things you might have done in an introductory CS class is actually implement a program that implements arithmetic or implements a very little calculator, maybe in prefix notation or infix notation, but how do you know how to write the code? If you are handed a grammar, it is actually incredibly easy to implement the parser because, in effect, you can simply implement a start equation method, a start term method, a start op method, a start value method, and then literally code it up in such a way that if you are called if you've called the start equation method, well, you better call the start term method followed by a literal read of an equal sign followed by another start term invocation. It's sort of a perfect application of the formalism to actual code. So XML, similarly defined via BNF grammar. What we'll offer in project one is a somewhat simplified grammar, and for tonight's purposes, a somewhat simplified grammar as well. XML, you probably have an appreciation of what it is, right? You know it when you see it. Well, how do you more formally define it? Well, here might be a grammar for a somewhat simplified format of XML. XML is made up of elements, which are start tags, followed by content, followed by end tags. Well, what's a start tag? Start tag is a literal open bracket, name, close bracket. What is an end tag? Same thing, but with the forward slash first. What's content? content is either an element or character data zero or more times. So if you're not familiar with regular expressions, a quick Google search will quickly acquaint you with it, but the star means zero or more occurrences, the bar here means or, and the parentheses just mean a grouping operator of some sort. What is name? Well, one or more characters excluding open, rather close angled bracket, and char data will be zero or more characters excluding open angled bracket. So this is a simplified form of XML, but certainly captures the spirit, or most of the spirit of XML. Well, why is it relevant? Well, in Project 1, as promised last week, we really take the hood off of XML and look at some of the underlying implementation details, hopefully present you with an underlying appreciation of what it means to parse an XML document, where the performance issues come into play, why DTDs and XML schemas will become so important, and why having a grammar on hand is so inherently necessary to actually parse or recognize a document correctly. Generally speaking, when you implement a parser, there's at least two aspects to it, a tokenization aspect and a recognition aspect of it. Tokenizing might typically mean something like this. An XML document is, in effect, a really long string. It might have some new lines, tab characters, but you can view it as a long string of characters. Tokenizing might mean iterating from start to end of that string, and every time you encounter an item of interest, like an angled bracket, you pop it off the string and you push it onto like a stack. Say, here's an interesting object. You might then parse the name of an element, students, S-T-U-D-E-N-T-S. Well, the S, not really interesting unto itself. The T, not, but the S-T-U-D-E-N-T-S together is interesting. Might be said to be a token. You might grab that whole string and put it aside as a token, and so forth. So all of the logical components of your document are generated or tokenized during this tokenization process. The recognition process is when you start looking through your tokens and realizing, oh, wait a minute, an open bracket token followed by a bunch of characters token, followed by a close bracket token, collectively represent a this higher level notion of a start tag, or the start of an element. So it might be phase 3 in which you call the content handler for start element. In phase 2, you would actually recognize that, oh, gee, these three tokens together represent a start element or a start tag, and in step 1, you actually break those into separate components. So that, in reverse order, is along the lines of, John, what you were talking about before. In mf.xml parser, the package in which we'll be working for Project 1 is called cseie259.project1.mf for my first. And it is your, hopefully, my first parser. In XML parser, we're not going to make this formal distinction of tokenization and recognition. More important will be to experiment with how you actually achieve both tasks on hand, the performance thereof, or the most intelligent, the most elegant implementation is not so much what we're prioritizing, since we are, after all, recognizing a very simple grammar. The actual XML parsers will not blur so much these distinctions, because the language itself is more complicated. The means via which you will implement this parser, or part thereof, is via a very standard technique. And John, actually, you put your finger on it before, recursive descent parsing. You essentially make a sequence of leaps of faith, if you will, with some error handling involved. But you essentially do as follows. You write a method that's responsible for parsing every non-terminal in the grammar. Well, what was a non-terminal? Well, a non-terminal in our simplified language was an element. So you'd have a method called readElement. You'd have a method called readContent. You'd have a method called readStartTag, readEndTag. You break up the non-terminals into these logical units, and then you implement a method that recognizes, or simultaneously tokenizes and recognizes, each of those conceptual units. You assume, at least initially, that the document matches the grammar. Otherwise, you'll drive yourself nuts if you implement too much error checking on your first pass through the code. You just assume that the very first character of the document is going to be open bracket. And we're not going to even support XML declarations, doctype declarations, process. It's not interesting for now. Pretty much just elements and attributes. The correct alternation in a rule, that is, what method you call next, can usually be determined with a little bit of look ahead. And I've used this term earlier. It usually suffices to read one maybe two characters ahead in your stream and say, oh, you know what? If I just saw an open bracket, I should probably call get start element again or the like. So you get a little bit of a hint from a look ahead buffer. And then eventually you recurse. And when you've read an element, well, an element can have other elements or character data, so you call get characters or get element and so forth. And then you would use exception handling often in this model because you get so nested in the parsing of this document that it tends to be easier to throw an exception and handle it at a higher level than try to pass back innumerable return values, because at least with exception handling and throwing an exception, you can determine where in the process an error actually occurred, and it's not lost in the subsequent return values of recursive calls. Quick look at some of the source code here. The project spec, I hope you will find to be incredibly detailed in what it walks you through. In fact, that's what you get for 16 pages of text. In the distribution, though, if you haven't noticed already, you'll have a few directories. Samples just contains those XML files you saw earlier. Source contains all of the source code, some of which we'll look at in lecture, but briefly, more time which we'll spend on in section, but it's optional because this is certainly code you can read through on your own. It's all commented and walked through in the handout to some extent. Build.xml. We'll be using for this and future projects Apache Ant, which is a nice Java-based build tool, and this too is fairly self-explanatory through comments. It essentially allows you to automate the process of building code. You can incorporate these build files into something like Eclipse or JBuilder if you like to use IDE's client-side. You can certainly run this at the command line, as we'll teach you in the project specification itself. Those of you who grew up on Make and GMake, this is one of the Java answers to a make build utility. Simply put, type ant, compiles all your code for you. And as an aside, FAS is apparently experiencing some high load lately, so if you're experiencing significant slowdown, probably not a bad idea to do your development on your own personal computer, especially if you're a professional developer and like doing that anyway. Just appreciate that some of the performance issues will hopefully go away in the next few weeks as FAS upgrades some of their systems, but an FYI. So in the source directory, though, there are a number of files, two of which I'll pull up for a moment. Tester.java, as we point out in the project spec, it's just a test utility, right? You're implementing an XML parser, which in and of itself is not really useful. It's useful when integrated into an application. So tester is that trivial application that we'll use or you'll use for testing your code. What this does is essentially the following. If you execute what we describe as the test case number one, what this class is defined to do is as follows. Instantiate one of your XML parsers. It's then going to do some buffered writing and just some messy Java details so that you can print some output to the screen. What it's then going to do is instantiate an XML serializer. A serializer, again, is just a program that takes, or a method that takes XML content in some form, whether it's a DOM or SACS events, and it serializes it to standard output. That is, it spits back out literal XML or literal text. We're then going to call your parser's parse routine. And that parse routine is going to jumpstart this recursive descent parsing process that we described in a conceptual sense earlier. Well, what exactly is this parser? Well, in XML parser.java, notice that we have some local variables. We have a reference to a content handler, and that recall is requisite because when this parse routine is called, not only are you given the file name to parse, but you're also given a reference to the content handler whose method should be called. So this is how your parser is going to keep around a recollection of what parser to call, what handler to call. Local index variable, and then up top, a local string variable. And that will be useful for our purposes insofar as, simply for the sake of simplicity, as I suggested before, we're just going to treat an XML document for now. It's just a long string of text. Arguably not the most efficient way to parse a document. If it's a large document, you just allocated a huge string on your stack or on your heap. But that's okay, because the point is to get the inner workings of XML across, not so much the performance aspects for now. In fact, your parser, however beautiful your code, probably will not be the same as performant as something like Xerxes. So if you're disappointed with how your parser turns out, never fear, you will halfway through project one be switching to an industry standard parser, but with lessons learned. And notice that my parse routine, which begins down here, does a few things, opening the file, reading the file into a string, sort of uninteresting utility details. But these last three lines are we come back on point. I am making this so-called leap of faith, and in this line of code, calling by default whatever handler I was passed, start document routine. Right? I know I'm parsing a document, so I can just blindingly just say start document and let that handler do whatever he wants to do with that call. I'm then going to make a similar leap of faith, and I am, as I suggested in our description of recursive descent parsing, just going to cross my fingers and hope that the first thing I can and should do with this document is read an element, the so-called root element. And you'll see in the spec that we've made, again, simplifications where you can assume that the first character initially will be an open bracket. So this will work initially, and it will be an iterative process, as you'll see in the spec, whereby we have actually implemented a good amount of the code. So I've actually implemented already read element, which I described earlier. And I've already implemented read end tag and read start tag and read text. So a lot of the infrastructure is already there. And as you'll see in the spec, you can run this thing out of the box and actually parse an XML document. For instance, if I build this thing, as I did a moment ago, and I execute Java of CSCIE 259.project1.mf.tester, and then I think one samples XML. So I'm running my first test routine on that same trivial 1.xml file. I got the arguments reversed from the top on down. Notice what happened. My test routine, again, was defined to instantiate an XML parser, associate it with whatever content handler is hard-coded into the test routine, call the parse method, and exit. Well, that parse method seems to have worked because it did parse the document because we didn't throw an exception at least. What did my content handler do? Well, what was the name of my content handler that I passed to the parse routine? It was called XML serializer. XML serializer, as the spec will walk you through it, it looks a little long, but it's really just some annoying pretty printing details, is essentially a class that is a sax handler. Notice these methods, end element, end document, characters, that if you look closely at the code are simply defined to print out the very XML document that was just parsed. So the net result is zero. In this process, you're parsing an XML document and getting back an XML document. But if correctly implemented, that's actually a wonderful thing if your input ultimately matches your output. And though there's a good amount of infrastructure in place for my first parser, what it does lack, among other things, is lacks handling of white space in a manner prescribed by the spec, and it also completely lacks support for attributes, which is why I took care to only implement this, only test this on 1.xml, which was a trivial document and I knew it wouldn't break. If you try running this on other sample documents we've provided, it will break, and break quite hard, it will. So Project 1 is all about filling in some of those blanks and then, in its latter part, actually going ahead and using Xerces for the first time, which is something we'll continue to do. So the SACS API tonight, again, if you want to remember a buzzword for tonight or a buzz phrase, fire and forget. Writing SACS event handlers is very easy. It's very quick. And even if you might not know where to start, just take great comfort in this document because it will hold your hands during the initial process of setting all of this up and getting started. But we'll see next week in particular that it certainly doesn't solve every problem. You'll see in your own implementation that a number of internal data structures are necessary to remember, in effect, where you are in the document. Following links in the document, going down into arbitrary places in the XML is non-trivial, if not impossible, with a SACS document. And it also is not well-suited for accessing multiple parts of the document simultaneously. And so hence the teaser for tonight is enter the document object model. So with that said, we'll call it a night. And for those of you who would like to stick around for section and Oreo cookies, we'll have section in room 106 in the same building. So see you soon, perhaps, or next week.